watch me while I sleep. Don't require your belief. Offering silence but no relief. Can you scream without a sound? Like the freeze that's coming down. Barren space where nothing grows. A secret place where no one goes.
Chaos Springs Eternal is a Delta Green actual play. Delta Green, by its nature, deals with violent themes, disturbing imagery, and horrors beyond our comprehension. Now, if you wouldn't mind comprehending some horrors with us, I think you'll have a good time. Hello and welcome back to Chaos Springs Eternal presents Season 1, City of Woe. Not going to wait for Noah's Woe this time, because again, Noah's not here, but we are here with Mark.
What up?
Playing Cyril.
Yep.
So let's jump into it. Yeah, okay. Cyril, you are sitting in front of a mirrored wall, basically, that's brightly lit. You're in this sort of, you know, the studio type chair, like the wooden scissor legs with the canvas bottom and back, and the woman is putting on your makeup, and I mean it's that heavy TV makeup, and so you've got all the bright lights to sort of imitate the lights that are going to be on TV.
Sure.
And as you wrap up, you see Joel walking out of sort of the studio, past the dressing room makeup area, and go ahead and make a humint roll.
Okay, hold on. I did not have roll 20 open. It's okay.
That's all right. I don't have roll 20 open either. So, you know, we're just playing this by ear.
Yeah, so I'll be interested to see what, when we listen to this, what's actually happening.
Yeah.
It's kind of our first foray into not knowing what the other players are doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Humint. Uh-huh. Success, 48 under 63.
Okay, so you see that his fists are clenched and his jaw is set, and he barely notices or acknowledges you and Marcy as he walks out, and he just kind of pushes out into the thing. And, you know, you guys are getting ready, and so they don't have anything mic'd up back here because they don't want any feedback or, you know, anything like that. Cynthia Whitehead comes by, and she finishes setting up your mic and says, okay, Nina is ready for you. So okay. They've already showed the footage, you know, and we're going to lead into Joel's first, but we're going to start intercutting, you know, you, Joel, and Marcy's comments and interviews and that sort of stuff. So it'll be kind of free flowing. Say as much as you want, you know, we'll cut it down to what you need. So. I think Nina might remind you of this when you get out there, but you're good to go.
All right, thank you, Cynthia. It's a pleasure seeing you again.
Oh, it's great. It's great seeing you. Can't wait to get this cut done and get an episode published. You know, with the heat from this viral video, it's going to be great.
Yeah, it'll be amazing. I'm sure of it. So,
and she leads you into the studio. And points you to another one of those sort of producer scissor type chairs sitting across from Nina Hernandez, who is looking through some notes she has on a clipboard, which she hands to Cynthia. Cynthia walks by, and Cynthia touches up her hair. Cynthia is running through like all the cabling and wiring, and you know, making sure everything's good. While she's mostly an equipment manager, she does make a lot of stuff happen, right? And so you are getting set, and Nina, you know, crosses her legs. She looks at you, and she's like, all right, Cyril, you ready?
I'm ready when you are, Nina. And I should say that Cyril is decked out. Like, he's wearing a beautifully tailored suit, like bright blue with like a gray vest, and his hair is perfectly coiffed. He looks like $1 million.
Oh yeah. And with the TV lighting and the extra makeup, I mean, it is, I mean, it's stunning. Impressive.
It's stunning.
Clooney-esque.
Clooney-esque. Very much so.
And, she says, okay, well, we're just going to start rolling and, I'll ask a question. Don't, you know, don't worry about any sort of like, you can talk as much as you want. If you get to rambling, we're all going to fix it in post. I mean, you know how cuts go here, right?
Like, yeah, I get it.
Things happen and it's going to sound great. No matter what you say, we'll make it sound great. So don't be worried about that. Don't be nervous. You know, I know you have less sort of on-camera experience than Joel, but I'm confident that you'll do great.
Yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to it, Nina. Let's get this going.
All right. So she looks at the camera and you see that she's got a little teleprompter and she says, I'm joined now by Cyril Moss. Cyril is a business owner in our own Care 4. He's also a military veteran. He runs ImageMaker Studios and he's of course related to Benjamin K. Taney, local Louisiana judge. So Cyril, you have just some interesting roots and connections here in Care 4. But one thing that I couldn't find in doing my research is what made you settle on Care 4 when you came back from the military?
Well, I was born and raised in Care 4. I mean, I was here. I did, other than a brief stint in the military, I've been here for most of my life. My parents, they're reverse snowbirds. They go up to Montana every year and they kind of stay up there now. They're up there to roost and I just kind of like it here. It's where I made my business and I've got a nice little spot downtown and I just love serving the community here of Care 4.
Well, you know, so many of our Care 4 native sons, they get up and they see the world and then they never really come back. So I think it's really special that you've made your way back here. Obviously, you know, your time in the military, I've got lots of questions about those. Is there, I guess one thing that I want to know though, is what initially drew you to the paranormal and got you involved in the Phantom Finders?
Well, that's a interesting story. You had mentioned my military service. I served as a scout and photographer for a forward advance unit in Afghanistan. And while I can't go into all the details of where I was or where I've been or things of those natures for classified reasons, I did my fair share of forward combat there. And one day I found a man. And I was taking photos to send back to headquarters to make sure that we were getting the right people. And maybe some of these folks that I take pictures of were, you know, in the card deck, if you will, of people we needed to get. And that night, a firefight broke out and I took a photo of a man that I had shot with my own weapon. And after that, part of me thought to myself, I have captured this man in a way that no other person can capture this man. I've captured him with a lens. I've captured him on a steel piece of film. And now I've also taken that man's life. Now, granted, he was firing at us, but there's just something about that I can't get over, really. Reminds me of, it's a very Aboriginal belief, but there's something that man, it feels like, I don't know who his family was, but feels like he's part of my family now. So I wanted to get into paranormal investigation because I needed to figure out if that was something that was true or if that was something that was just, you know, a fly-by-night feeling. And so I've met up with the Phantom Finders and I mean, the rest is clearly history because we figured it out. So I think we did a pretty good job.
There is, Nina Hernandez is a professional, but even with what, I don't know what your humint is, but it didn't take much for your humint to pick up on a little bit of her jaw dropping when you shared this story that I think it's maybe a little more... I think it's almost the nonchalance at which you share some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, oh, well, okay. I understand your time in the military was formative. And you see her like touch her fingers to her ear. And she says, let's go into this latest haunting over at Florizon Manor. Is now, obviously, Joel told us that there were some details that we can't get into. But was there anything in the house that stuck out to you as the most, you know, wild manifestation of this ghost, this little girl ghost?
I mean, I don't know what Joel told you, but, I mean, we saw, I mean, other than this little girl, you know, you see in the movies all the time, all those things, like there's that famous scene in Ghostbusters where books are floating across shelves and, you know, things are covered in ectoplasm and all this stuff. Well, that sort of happened to us, minus all the goo, essentially. So, you know, this little girl made books float. She was rearranging bookshelves. It was a wild time in there. It was a wild time. And I can't get into too many details about it, but the things that I have seen now have only furthered my wanting to see more. And I sure hope that we can spin this up into something that becomes a little more, now that we know, becomes a little more poignant.
Excellent. That's great. Now, the internet and the online boards are all alive with all sorts of chatter about this footage that's gone absolutely viral. I mean, there's, mm-hmm. you know, people claiming it's CGI. People are putting their own theories about this little girl ghost. Joel wanted to keep sort of the name under wraps, but is there anything about this little girl ghost that you wanted to share? Maybe something that impacted you about her story, anything like that?
I think that the thing that captured me about her story is how much of an imposter she was. I mean, we went in there researching, doing all the things we needed to do, and we found this wonderful story. I mean, it wasn't wonderful, but it was a story that was kind of human and kind of had a, you know, a little bit of a feeling to it. You know, you could feel with the people involved. And then this imposter shows up and she just spoils the whole show because she's evil as all get out. And here we are trying to put to rest some kind of like story about loss. And then this little thing shows up and she's evil. And I have no doubt that she has some sort of evil intentions. She had evil intentions for us. That is for certain. There cannot be any denying that. But she's just an imposter in that house. She don't belong there. So we got rid of her.
She says, yes, you know, we heard what happened with Marcy. Obviously, our hearts go out to Marcy. Glad that she is on the mend.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any time during this investigation where you felt that you were in trouble or in threatened? I mean, obviously you seem like you can take care of yourself. Was there any time when you were truly spooked or frightened by this?
I mean, there were times, yeah, but there comes a time, and especially when, you know, I can't speak for the rest of the Phantom Finders, but there comes a time when you realize that you need to either put up or you need to shut up. And we had reached that point many times. And so as scared as I was sometimes, especially in the beginning, when we were running in and out of that house, it was like a Scooby-Doo cartoon, us running through doors in and out of that house. It was crazy. But at a certain point, you have to start doing the things that are necessary to make sure that entity doesn't hurt nobody else. And you got to really put your nose to the grindstone and get stuff done. And it felt a lot of the time like I had to do that. I mean, there was a time where my colleagues was looking at me like, you realize what you just did. And I said, yeah, because I had to. I had no choice. And part of that is me being in a forward position in the war and having to deal with those kind of commands and having to do the things necessary. But another part of me just you just got to know sometimes. And sometimes the only way you can know is by uncovering everything you can.
Well, we are certainly looking forward to the premiere of this episode covering the Florizon Manor. Is there anyone that you would like to shout out or thank as part of all of this? You know, we just want to give y'all the opportunity to recognize anyone else, you know, either in the Phantom Finders or around the Phantom Finders that you want to in this interview who we don't get to interview directly.
Yeah. I mean, I love my Phantom Finders. Joel was fantastic the whole way through. He did the things. He was definitely the one who was most in tune with trying to figure out how to get rid of this particular ghost. Mossy was fantastic with her research. She could do, I mean, that woman can do research like there's no tomorrow. And she was uncovering things left and right. It was amazing to watch her work. And even when she was all laid up and banged up, and I know that she wanted to get down to the bowling alley and lay out some pins, she came to the Phantom Finders and she did work. And I appreciate that for her. And then, you know, I lended my own expertise in terms of footage. And let me say this right off, Nina, that every single frame that we captured is real. It is not CGI. I've been a photographer and a videographer for too long to do that kind of nonsense. And there's nothing we need to fake. That's what I'm going to say right now is, and I think Cyril looks right into the camera and is just like, it is 100% real. And I'll stake my reputation on it. And you guys can come at us with all your CGI nonsense and it's going to come up true. And then you're going to owe me and everyone else a huge apology. But other people that helped us along the way, I'd love to shout out my girl down at the esoteric bookstore, Luna. She was fantastic. She helped us out big time. I can't wait to see her again. Just everyone involved. It was such a good operation. And it was hard. It was hard for all of us. But the police did their job. They came when we needed them to. And everything's been great. So those are the people that really made this possible.
Well, thank you, Cyril. Just been a pleasure chatting with you. And you have a great day. I think that's all we need from you.
Sounds good, Nina. Thank you.
Cynthia comes by and she begins unhooking your audio. And Nina says, well, you kind of beat me to the punch. I had I called one of your old squad buddies and gotten a little bit of the lowdown on that, what happened overseas. And so I thought I was going to press you a little bit on that story, but you were very upfront about it. I got to hand it to you. You were very upfront about it.
There's no reason to hide, Nina. There's no reason to hide. Things happen in war. I mean, if you don't come back from war change, you didn't come back as far as I'm concerned. And that's what happened. Nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, I shot a man. I'm not proud of it, but I did what I had to do. And anybody could find that out. It's all right.
Yeah. All right. Well, you are free to go. I think Marcy's up next. So, thanks for swinging by. And, she shakes your hand and she lets her hand linger just like a second longer than you think would be normal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Cyril smiles, just gives her, you know, flashes her, you know, big smile and just says, "Hi, Nina. It was a wonderful, wonderful job. Thank you."
As you head out the studio, you push out the doors. And when you push out the doors, there's a moment where you are in the sand and desert. And you just like around you, you feel that sort of hot wind whipping up. And you hear the sounds of gunfire. And I need you to go ahead and make a sanity roll.
I knew you'd get our sanity points somehow.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk. What's your sanity at right now? Where's your breaking point?
I am actually doing really well on sanity. I have a 76 sanity.
All right. Well, go ahead and roll your sanity on this.
That is a success.
Okay. So just take 1 point of sanity damage here. As you sort of shake your head and your eyes clear and you are in the parking lot at WCLA.
Yeah. And is it evening? What time of day is it?
We're talking like probably 4:30, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think he would get in his truck and.
Oh, and I just remembered, you can always project that sanity loss if you want to. Or something that I learned today as I was looking a little bit more is that there's actually like a grin and bear it type of thing.
For oh, really? Sanity.
Yeah. So let's.
Yeah, it's just a point. I'm not going to.
Yeah, but I just, as long as we're thinking about this, you know, there's the. Yeah, okay, resisting. We've got adaptation, which is unnatural, so you don't get any checks for adaptation. Mm-hmm. You got projecting onto a bond, and then you have repressing insanity, which I didn't know you could just do. So
that seems bad. Yeah.
I've read this so many times, and right. I just didn't know. It's just you roll 1d4, reduce your willpower by that, and then as long as you have at least one willpower left, you reduce the sanity by loss by that much. And then you kind of describe how the bond might help your agent. So this feels like it's the same as projecting onto a bond, but it's not quite.
Yeah. Cause you're losing willpower to do that.
Yeah. Right? I mean, yeah, you still spend willpower for the projecting onto a bond loss. Maybe I have like a weird printing of this.
I'll have to check mine. I don't know. Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard. I know that there was always like you could fuck up your bonds to, you know, not take sanity loss. But it does make sense that you'd be able to like power through something.
Yeah, but these both hurt the bonds.
Really?
Yeah.
That's weird. Well, the thing is, the difference is.
Oh, you know what? Okay. I get this. The difference is that projecting onto a bond is the sand loss, and repressing insanity is dealing with a temporary insanity.
Oh, where
if you take more than 5,
right,
you can reduce that amount by 1d4.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That makes more sense. Okay, yeah, you shake that vision from your vision and head back to the car. So yeah, we're talking about like probably 4:30 in the afternoon on Wednesday.
Yeah, I think that this is on Wednesday, so we've had a night to rest. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then doing this interview is Joel anywhere around here?
Joel, you see Joel sitting in his car with the window down and his hands outside the window. It almost looks like he's thinking that he's driving, but he's texting on his phone.
Okay. Yeah, I'll save you from having to play Joel's character here. And
before long, he pulls out of the, parking lot, and actually you see him pull out of the parking lot and he starts to drive on the road. And then you see him just brake suddenly, and stay there for like maybe 10 or 15 seconds and then just keep driving. And that's actually what happens.
That's fantastic. Yeah, so Cyril will kind of shake his head at that one, and then he'll get into his truck. And yeah, I think that it's Wednesday night. I think Cyril just goes home. He hasn't been home other than to like do his ritual bathing and things like that in a minute. So I think he will go home and, you know, check all of his. Try to go through the foot. Oh, you want? Oh, and then we also need to do the cutting, right? Like the editing.
Yeah, yeah. You can get that done whenever you want. I mean, you could stay here and work on that if you wanted. But if you want to get home, you can get home. You know.
Yeah. Well, you know what I'll do. I will stay and cut. I will do the editing.
And maybe you can even say that you've done some of that in like the Wednesday morning. I know we had talked about you going back to Glomas's today, but I think when the invitation was extended for the interview, y'all all sort of powwowed and agreed to go do the interview.
Okay.
I think you and Joel were definitely more enthusiastic about it than Marcy.
For sure.
just based on what I know about your characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you could have come here during today and been cutting up the some of the footage. And so you could be pretty much done with the edit if okay. you want.
Yeah.
I can't think of like, or you could roll and see how much, how good you've done on the edit, you know, like a, I don't know how much progress you've made if you want.
Yeah, let's do that. It's always okay. fun to roll stuff. Let's see. Demolitions?
Yeah.
No, probably. I don't know. Is there a computer? I don't have any computer science. I mean, art. I do have art. Trying to think of what I could leverage here to do this mundane task.
Art or, I don't know. Do you have anything specific to your photography? I'd let that translate over.
Yeah. I have art photography.
Yeah. Let's roll that.
Success.
Okay, good. Yeah. So you've gotten like most of it done, you know, you probably have some bumpers that you need to run, and then just a matter of like the final, any voiceover or anything that you might need to get Joel to run back and record.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that he's got that done, and I think he just kind of goes home, and I think he is also going to go through the rest of his footage just to see what is salvageable, because a lot of it is probably just, you know, staring at a piano for 6 straight hours.
Yeah, so I mean, as you scrub through the footage, you might find a handful of other frames that are kind of interesting or neat, you know, just the play of shadows or for some from your like latest, you know, that last, the actual exorcism. I think that you guys caught some frames. I don't think that you had filmed much of the exorcism itself.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think he always had a camera on him, but I mean, his hands were doing other stuff. So
yeah. So yeah, you scrub through the footage. You find a handful of things that I think are good. Sort of,
yeah.
You mark them for like mood boosters, and maybe this would be a good sort of like
teaser. Or, you know. I think also we have not talked about what Cyril has done with the Organite.
No, not specifically.
Yeah, I think that he. I guess I need to stop saying I think Cyril has it as like a fidget, like he's using it as like a fidget, turning it over in his hand over and over and over again, while he's at home scrubbing through stuff. I don't think it leaves his house, but I think when he's there, he is actively using it or actively manipulating it a lot. Other than that, it goes in his gun safe. Okay. He does not want it really out in his apartment, but he will go get it when he wants to handle it.
Very interesting. That's such a nice little nugget that I am excited to see what comes from that.
Yeah.
So after scrubbing the footage, do you want to head back to Florizon? Do you want to, what do you want to do?
Well, I think he spends Wednesday night sleeping. I think.
Yeah.
And then I think the next day he gets up and he goes back and he goes to Florizon Manor. And I don't know how the other ones or how Joel and Marcy are going to deal with this, but I think that he feels obligated to be there because him and Gloma, like, they need to figure this part out. But and I don't know if we're going to do like a rotation. I don't know if Joel's going to come out here at like noon or, you know, something like that. But I think he would go out there first thing in the morning.
Yeah, Joel. I mean, the tricky thing with Joel is that he has a job. And so,
yeah, that's true.
He may be less available for some of these things. But if you head out there Thursday, could you make me let's make an alertness check for this Thursday morning. Oh, you know, one thing before you do this, actually, that I forgot to do. Was you can go ahead and advance your character. So you can click that little button.
Oh, cool.
Move forward. I forgot to tell you that earlier, but I don't think it makes a huge difference at this point.
Yeah, bump my human by 1.
Cool.
And my alertness by, I think, 4 points. So
cool. All right. Well, let's roll that alertness then and see.
I got a question for you, and I never get these things right. And this is just between DM. This is just a DM question. these adapted to things. Like I have clicked for violence one.
Okay.
I don't know. Am I supposed to be clicking these at a certain point? Am I only supposed to click them when you tell me to click them?
If you pass a sanity check for one of those,
mm-hmm.
You should click it. Yeah.
Okay. Cause I have not been doing that. I mean, I've been clicking. I have one clicked.
Yeah. Most of the sanity though has come from unnatural. We haven't had a lot of helplessness or violence yet.
Got it. Okay. Just checking. I didn't know how those things really worked. And I don't know what, I mean, so when I click all three for violence, I just am immune to like violence.
Yeah. You won't lose sanity from violence.
Got it.
Until you hit your breaking point.
Got it. Okay. So alertness. Here we go. Success. 48 under 68.
Okay, so it's Thursday, I guess if you're heading out to Florizon Thursday morning, does that sound right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you notice that, like, it's just, like, the traffic's a little heavier than you would expect. Like, and just, like, it's weird that there's traffic in Florizon normally, or not Florizon, in Care 4. Normally, Care 4 just almost has no traffic. You know, there's never a big wait at any stoplights or stop signs. And you just notice like a handful more cars. And then you notice, I think that being the perceptive guy that you are, you notice that a lot of these license plates are out of town. And you think, you know, maybe a lot of them are from Rhode Island. And so you think maybe these are like rental cars.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's just something that you notice as you head out to Florizon Manor.
The Rhode Island's a nice touch. All right. Yeah. So he'll make his way out there. He's not going to be flashy about this. I think that he realizes that people can't find Florizon Manor, because it would only make things more problematic. Cyril was expecting kind of a surge in people coming to the town, which he's really looking forward to. So he heads out to Florizon Manor in his Cyclone.
Do you head straight in? How do you case the joint, or what do you want to?
I think that he parks around back so that there's not like a car in the driveway.
Okay.
Like I think tries to make it so that his truck is obscured by some sort of barn or whatnot. And I think that he would go, I think he would make sure that there was nobody around. He would walk around the building a little bit just to make sure that it wasn't, you know, there wasn't, the mayor's not here or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, as you look, you know, you had come out of this Tuesday night and you don't notice anything different or changed. It looks like doesn't seem like anyone else has been around. I don't know. Do you want to go into Florizon? Do you want to go?
Yeah.
You know, okay. Yeah. You head into Florizon, and as you do, you kind of like the moment you like open the door, there's this sort of like weird feeling for a second. You kind of get confused as to what you were doing. But then, I mean, it's just a brief moment. And then you kind of push through, and you are back in.
Yeah. And, he will, Glomus, are you here? Glomus, are you here? It's, Cyril.
And you hear, up from the basement, you hear,
yes, come on down. You can help me move some things.
Oh yeah. I was going to help you do that. So, Cyril walks downstairs, fully expecting to see Glomus in his full ghoul form.
So as you head down the stairs, pushing around the corner, you see Glomus is actually the bar that Marcy fell on in that room. He has moved out some of the chairs and benches and cleared it out a little bit. And you see that he has begun what looks like carving something into the floor, like a big circular diagram. And he says,
thank you for coming to help me. I suppose that the spell at the entryway did not take full effect on you as was intended.
Yeah, there was definitely a moment of kind of confusion, but I think we're all good now.
Good, good.
You've been hard at work in here.
Well, yes, I don't need to eat or sleep or any of that, true. So I had no other thing to dedicate. And this is very important to me to get done, so...
Yeah, I can imagine.
As he sort of finishes one of these wide outer rings of the circle that he's carving in, he says,
"I have some things that I need to bring in here. Would you follow me back to my laboratory?"
Oh, of course, of course. Everything in this room is stable, though. Like, you're not gonna like.
Yes,
it's not gonna come alive. I don't know, so something like that while we're walking around.
No. There's nothing like that. This room is very safe, and anyone who comes into the manor should basically forget why they were here and feel the need to go take care of something at home. So it's a temporary protection just for while we do this work. But it can be overcome by anyone with strong enough mental fortitude and obviously anyone who I have specifically allowed to sure. come in. So yeah.
That makes sense.
And he opens the portal into that room where you had first seen Antoine's body, and then opens another portal into the rock wall, the smuggler's tunnels behind that, and he begins making his way back through these, you know, just ancient. I mean, they don't feel ancient, but this like old tunnel system
sure.
that you I don't think anyone had really any idea was down here.
Right,
it would definitely be unusual for Louisiana,
especially with like the water table so high there.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know. You're a natural still at zero, right? I haven't given you guys any points.
No, I'm still at zero. Yeah.
But you kind of, I think at this point, you guys all have to kind of intuit that there's something magical going on here.
For
like
sure.
there's the engineering. I think I had y'all make engineering checks. And you were like, oh, yeah, this is well built, but it still doesn't answer the question of why it can do all that it's doing.
Yeah.
as he makes his way back to the laboratory, he heads back to some of the parts that you hadn't, like, seen. And if you head back there with him, I mean, there's just this, like, there's cardboard boxes that are filled with sort of these chunks of, you know, crystal and metal and like leather pouches. And I mean, they're probably 20 to 30 pounds each.
And well, he says, I only need a handful more of these things, but.
And he points to like two or three different boxes. He says,
these will be consumed as I cast, the spell. The actual casting will take several days, it will extract a heavy cost, but I had the foresight to set these things up, and once I lay it all out, I will be able to tell if I'm missing something or if we need to obtain any more material. But if you would help me.
And he grabs like two of those boxes, and he's kind of walked with this hunch, but when he picks up these boxes and stacks them, there's a moment where he stands up to his full, like, 8.5 feet tall. And it is just a little bit disturbing.
Unnerving, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
go ahead and make a search roll while you're back here.
Search roll. Oof.
Ooh.
I'm going to spend
54 over 53. I mean,
I'm going to spend a luck just to see what I see here.
Okay.
Can I do that?
Yeah. So you see like one of the boxes that he doesn't point to has got the top open, And, you know, you just catch a little like look through the top and, you know, I mean, he's in no rush and he's not like paying too much attention to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. As he begins to carry these boxes out and is trusting that you were following him, you see a knife in there, like a big hunting knife, like a 6-inch blade, and it has KAR inscribed on the sheath. You see another knife. It's a Bowie knife that's probably like a, you know, almost a foot long blade, with a solid wood handle, and like brass ornamentation. And you see like 30 pencils, like brand new pencils, completely unsharpened. But each of these pencils erasers have been worn down to bare metal. You see a book. You can barely make out the title of the book. It's actually, you can't make out like the top line, but the bottom line is of science, and underneath that is Dr. Harlow Y. Patton, and 1971. It's this, like, it's kind of a weird book. It's like leather bound, but then there's also like twine for the like binding part of it.
Patton, like, and General Patton or Patton?
P-A-T-T-E-N.
P-A-T-T-E-N. Okay.
And all of that in this box is sitting on what you are, I mean, it looks like just like rings of metal, but you think it might be like actual chainmail.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So like Renaissance fair chainmail. Medieval. Yeah. Does it look old? Is it like tarnished and rusty in spots, or is it well maintained?
It doesn't seem super well maintained, but the big thing is like the rings on them are like almost an inch around, and so looking at it and it's like that would probably not be the most useful chainmail,
right? Okay. So,
like,
yeah, that's
it feels like a lot of arrows could get through that. So
okay, 1-inch rings.
Yeah, so that's what you see in that box.
And there's nothing written on the box. It's just in cardboard box.
It's just one of the boxes that's back here.
KAR, is it like initials?
It looks like it is. Yeah, I mean, they're all caps and
okay
periods after them.
Got it. So, okay, so someone's initials or something along those lines. Interesting. Science of Harlow Y. Patton. Okay. All right. And yeah, he will grab up the stuff and kind of hustle along after Glomus, and he'll be, Glomus, I got a question for you.
Yes, what can I tell you?
Well, when you moved in here, did you ever find anything cool? Like, I mean, we knew that this place was used as like a French smuggling ground. I don't know if you found anything like really cool, like maybe like a cask of wine or something very French, a guillotine, you know, something along those lines.
He says,
I had many wonderful copper pots, but they have long since been worn through with my experimentations. I had a handful of things that I have absconded with from the manor during the early days, but it soon, fewer and fewer people came to the manor, so there was not much. Most of it had been cleared out, but there's a handful of various items that, you know, old bullets and these things.
Interesting. All right. I was, you know, I have a two-part thing for me coming out here. One, I told you I would, and I did. The next thing is I'm really trying to do my due diligence on solving this murder of the mayor's brother.
Yes,
so
yes.
I would really love it if at some point during the day, if you needed like a break, I'm willing to stand here and, you know, sit here and help you do whatever you need to do. It's no rush, but I would like, if at all possible, to have you turn back into Antoine's body so I can examine it a little more closely, kind of like what Detective Ma did, but maybe not that intimate. And you can, we can kind of go over the body again. Is that a possibility?
He says, as you make your way into the manor and, you know, set these boxes down, and he begins pulling these various items and placing them at various points in the circle. He says,
yes, I could turn back into Antoine's body, or I could also give you access to Antoine's body. Is that something you would want?
Yeah. I mean, I would just have, you know, as long as you are willing to answer some clarifying questions. And I don't know, how well are you able to preserve that body?
It is in a state of repose now, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't mind looking at it if that's a, you know, nothing macabre. I'm just trying to do my due diligence here and help figure out what actually happened to this poor man.
Of course, of course. Well, tell you what, it is, I can show you where the body is, and I can come back here and work on placement, and then when you are done with your examination, you can come consult me, ask me any questions that you need.
Okay.
Is that sound?
Yeah, that works for me. I didn't know if you want me to be a lookout, like sit on the front porch kind of thing.
No. The spell at the gate should suffice, and also it gives me a little alert when someone is coming.
Okay. I just wanted to be, you know, but if you need me to run interference, is there a way for you to, like, communicate with me if we're this far separated?
No. If there is trouble, I will simply hide.
Okay.
Best opportunity for me.
I was hoping for walkie-talkie code names for us, but I guess that's not going to happen.
He like, looks at you quizzically for a second. He has no idea if you're messing with him or not.
I'm not messing with you. I really do. This is one of the things I really loved about being overseas, is our walkie-talkie code names. It was my pleasure. I would make them up all the time, along with the, you know, the military alphabet. I mean, I don't know how many times I called someone a eunuch. It was amazing. I miss that.
This is
okay. Well, what would your name be?
You may call me General Beauregard.
Okay, and what should my name be?
Dennis Rodman.
Dennis Rodman.
Because you're okay. 8 foot tall and you look like you could rebound a basketball.
Oh, I love that. All right. So he leads you back to his lab, and around the corner, sort of deeper in that storage, he moves aside a cloth covering on a table, and you see Antoine's body. And it's much more sort of pallid and gray than the body that he transformed into. Obviously, you know, just representing the time difference from when he found the body to when he actually brought it back here.
He says, okay, you can begin your investigation. And,
okay.
When you are done, come see me.
Got it, Dennis Rodman. Thank you.
Yes, General Beauregard.
Yep, you got it. See, it's fun, huh?
Yes,
next time we're out here, we can make new ones. It'll be so good. I promise I won't just get all bad boy pistons for you, but I'll get some good ones for you.
Okay.
And he lopes back through the tunnels. What sort of role do you want to make on Antoine's body? There's other stuff going on here, I know, how much are you investigating cause of death versus how much are you just trying to understand the body, I guess, is where
I mean, it is really kind of a dual purpose. I am trying to do both things. So I guess I will figure out cause of death. But I mean, I don't quite remember all that's happened to the body. And
So I think what I had said, and I reserve the right to wreck on a little, but I think what I had said is that there was actually, let me just search my notes. Here we go. So you see a knife. So this is what Detective Marr had said when he was investigating Antoine's body when Glomus had transformed. He noticed a knife wound. He figured that it had been dead for somewhere between 6 and 12 hours, but there was no blood, which Glomus confirmed. There were no puncture wounds, and that the spleen had been removed.
And where were the? Where was the knife wound?
The knife wound was the one in his torso.
Whereabouts in the torso?
I mean, under the ribs.
So like up and under the ribs, searching, like digging for a heart kind of thing?
It's more straight across the ribs, across that sort of under the ribs, almost as if it was trying to like open up the stomach area.
Oh, like it was a laceration across it? It wasn't a puncture wound.
Right. Yeah. Okay. It's a big, long gash. And that's how Detective Marr was able to sort of like access the thoracic cavity, was by actually reaching in this.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, I couldn't remember. And there were no puncture marks, puncture wounds anywhere. And it had been ensanguinated?
Yeah, you assume that there might have been some exsanguination. And Detective Marr said that he couldn't really tell if it was, pre or post.
Yeah. Okay. And then I guess my question is other than the spleen, did Glomus remove anything during his ritualistic cannibalization of the corpse?
So he did eat the heart.
Okay. So the heart is also missing, but that was something he ate to sustain himself.
Correct.
Okay.
One of the first scenes of this campaign.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So laceration. Any other, like, is there defensive wounds on his hands?
Do you want to make a roll of some sort?
Yeah. Why don't I roll?
You can make like a search or like a medicine roll.
I'll do maybe criminology.
Criminology would be great.
Let's see what I can do here. Success, 17 under 54.
Okay. So this is where I get to do cool stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you're
yeah.
searching his body and his actual body. And you do notice a couple things that Glomus didn't recreate exactly. Like the cut that Glomus did was a little bit cleaner. This one's a little bit more jagged.
Okay.
So it looks a little more haphazard. It's still relatively like straight across and was clearly done sort of in one blow. But as you're sort of searching the rest of the body, you are working your way down his arms. And one of the things that you notice on him that you didn't notice on Glomus is you see a faint outline of something on his hand. And with your criminology, I'm going to go ahead and say that you have some sort of like UV light. I don't think that's
not too far out field. Yeah.
No, that's something that, again, ghost hunters and photography, I think that there's room for that. And as you wave that UV light, you see that his hand was stamped.
Oh, like a club? Like
a club. And in fact, Cyril probably recognizes this club. This is a club in New Orleans. Give me a second and let me figure out what name the club is, unless you...
Club John Sally.
This is the Riverbend Blues Lounge.
Oh, so it's not Bayou Blues and Beads. Okay.
No.
Riverbend Blues Lounge?
Riverbend Blues Lounge.
Cool. Got it. I can hear you typing stuff into Obsidian as we speak. Awesome. Okay. So anything else? So like that, that's probably his left hand or right hand. Like on the back of his hand kind of thing?
Yeah, back of his left hand.
Left hand. Okay. Well, that's a good clue that we could try to trace back. All right. And then, let me just ask this one last time so I know where this is. So like when you're talking about the laceration that goes across his body, usually when you try to like disembowel somebody, you're going to cut low, right? Because you want the guts to like fall out. It's, you said it was higher than that, right? It was like around his, like at like his diaphragm area.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Just checking. I didn't want to get that part wrong.
Yeah. And maybe I might have described it a little differently than Detective Marr, but chalk that up to, you know.
Yeah.
Cool recreations.
All right. And then nothing wrong with his face or hands or, I mean, head or any other scuff marks on him.
No, honestly, it doesn't look, you don't notice any wounds, any defensive wounds aside from, you know, the obvious one. But it doesn't look, I mean, no broken bones, no, you know, no signs of struggle.
Okay. I think that he's gotten all he needs off the body. But he will go back to Glomus if you don't mind real quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey Glomus, I got a couple questions for you.
Yes.
I just looked at the body. I think we uncovered something. I found something on his hand that I don't think you probably didn't know about because it's under a UV light or, you know, black light kind of thing. Yeah, I found a stamp for a club in New Orleans. So that's something we could try to figure out. So I think that's a good thing that happened today. My question is, and I know that the hurricane had probably done a number on where you found this body, but like, was he in a state of rigor? Like, had he gone, like, what kind of shape was he in? Like, what, how was he laying when you found him?
He was laying in an open field.
Yeah. No, I get that. But like, let me put it this way. There's a way that people will like toss a body and just because they don't care about it, like they'll throw it out like a moving car kind of thing. And that's somebody that shows that they don't care about what happens to the body or this person. It's a way of being humiliating or a way of showing no remorse. And then there's another way where you purposely lay the body out in a reverent manner. Doesn't mean it needs to be like hands on chest and, you know, throwing up the papal sign or anything like that. But like, there's a difference when you lay somebody to rest as opposed to chucking a body in a field. Do you understand?
Yes, I think I understand. I can tell you that there was no roads close to this field. And I did not notice any cars or tire marks, but the hurricane may have wiped that away.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And like I said, was it just laying? Did anyone pose the body? I guess is what I'm asking.
It did not seem to have any special orientation, but again, it may have been lost in the for sure. wind and rain.
One of these days, you're going to have to take me out to that field. I gotta see it for myself. I just got to, you know, I just got to know where this poor sap ended up.
Yes, I may need a break between the construction of this circle and the actual casting of the spell. And in that time, we could go.
Yeah, why don't we make a plan on that? And we'll just go out to the field. And I just kind of want to see where it's at and just kind of get the feel for what's happening out there. What do you...
That is amenable to me.
Okay. And, you know, maybe... Yeah, you're welcome to come. Is it a walk from here? Like, how could we get there?
And he laughs. He says,
I forget. I do not tire when walking, so it's not a big deal to me, but it is several miles away.
Okay.
It may be worth.
Yeah, you can get in my pickup truck. You can change into something a little more formal, I guess, a little more human. I don't know if my tiny little pickup truck's going to be able to carry you around, Dennis Rodman, but you're going to have to get in with something a little more comfortable for that kind of cabin, but or you can ride in the back. We can go full old school, you know, dirty white boys in the back of the truck.
He gives you what can only be described as a quizzical look. And he says,
I have a form that I will take, Captain Beauregard, when we go. It will not be Antoine's, as that would probably raise more questions.
All right. Well, let's plan on that. And then I think we're getting close on this one, or at least closer. I think if I can look at the area where they were, where you found the body, I think we'll be better off.
Yes, yes. That there may be things that I did not see or was not able to see.
Yeah.
I think it would be nice if you did, I will take you up on that lookout offer. Mm-hmm. Just as I set these things out.
And yeah. He's moving like these leather pouches, and he'll pull one and he'll like walk to a specific part of the circle. He'll look at the center and you can see him doing some mental calculations, and then he will pour out this bag of dust or fine powder into specific spots. And then in another place, he'll go place one of the crystals. And it's a very methodical, purposeful thing that he's doing.
And, okay. Yeah, I think Cyril will sit in like the front library room, I guess, and just look out the window and just make sure that nobody's coming up the road or. Yeah.
All right. And you you gaze out the window on what is beginning to be a warm Thursday afternoon in Louisiana. And that's where we're going to wrap it up for tonight.
Hell yeah.
Thank you once again for tuning in to Chaos Springs Eternal Presents Season 1, City of Woe. This is a Delta Green actual play. Shout out to Arc Dream Publishing for putting out Delta Green. It's my favorite role-playing system. So thank you to those guys, and thank you to all of you for listening. Please make sure that you go rate and review us on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. I know Google Podcasts is wrapping up here soon, so RIP. We are going to start putting these out to YouTube as well, so make sure you go check our check the link in the show notes and go ahead and subscribe to our YouTube for when that happens. Every little bit helps, guys. We really appreciate the feedback that we've been getting. Make sure you email us once you've done your review, and if you give us an NPC name, we'll happily incorporate them. We're going to start seeing more NPCs here. Probably not the next episode, because next episode we're going to be interviewing Marcy with some downtime. But after that, we are going to have more characters join us in Care 4. So thank you for listening, and thank you to Pawns Over Kings for Cositus. This is our theme song, so let's listen to it. Finish it out. Don't let me drink.